The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 18th of March, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Michael Masterman, chairman of W Resources, W-R-E-S, ticker there. And Michael provides an update on the progress at La Parrilla, its flagship tungsten tin mine in Spain and other parts of the business. I also have on Hayden Locke, Chief Executive Officer at Emerson, EML is ticker there, and Hayden explains the significance of completing their environmental baseline study at their Chemisset Potash project in Morocco. And it's a Monday, so Malky's on, oil and gas sector specialist, talking about Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas, Range Resources, Bahamas Petroleum and Hurricane Energy. I also have on today, and this is worth listening to, really is, and I haven't read the book yet, but I'm going to read it. It's John Stepick. He's an executive editor of Money Week magazine and author, and this is a new book we're talking about, Skeptical Investor, How Contrarians Bet Against the Market and Win, and You Can Too. We have a really interesting chat. I really enjoyed chatting to John, and I'm going to get the book because it makes a lot of sense there. And it's about what being a contrarian investor is, you know, and almost helps you through that maze, and how, you know, proper, that's the way you should invest. Proper investors who are big contrarians make lots of money. And he sort of breaks that down. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists on the front page of Vox, that's voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see a whole heap of other content, including stuff from SP Angels Morning View, Strategic Minerals acquires a full ownership of Redmore Project, and also content there on Emerson. But lots of stuff there, voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Masterman, chairman of W Resources. W-R-E-S is the ticker there, of course. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Great to be on Vox, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Are you in sunny Spain or some other foreign clime?
I'm not in Spain at the moment, but I've been there for the last 2 weeks, and it's great to see so much progress on the ground.
Yeah, well, you've released an RNS, you know, quantifying that progress there, and we'll get into that a bit, not just at La Parrilla, but the other interests you have. And I suppose, you know, it's always good to say that, because I think some people focus on La Parrilla, which is, of course, it's going ahead very well, but you've got other things going on. So just for people not aware, Michael, just give them a summary of the company, please, if you could.
Okay, so W Resources is focused primarily on tungsten in Spain and Portugal. And we've also got a fantastic gold deposit, São Martinho, in central Portugal. Our two main projects in Spain, in tungsten and tin, are the La Parrilla mine, which is our flagship, and which is in southwestern Spain, and Régua, which is in north eastern Portugal.
Okay. Like I say, La Parrilla is your main focus at the moment, and you're developing the mine there at the moment. But so take us through what's the progress that you're achieving there, and we'll cover the other bits as well.
Well, Justin, it's been a fairly intense first quarter of 2019 with huge amounts of progress on all fronts. I guess most specifically at La Parrilla, there's three parts to La Parrilla. There's the crusher, the jig, and the concentrator. The crusher was finished last year. That is fully commissioned, fully operational, and is run at full design capacity. So that's in great shape. And we can run that crusher, which is a huge machine, 350 tons per hour with one operator. Where the action is coming forward is firstly on the jig. The jig is a key piece of equipment that allows us to take the crushed ore from the crusher and effectively double the grade of the ore before it goes into our concentrator. So we're very keen to get the jig completed and up and running and integrated with the concentrator. We've made a lot of progress, particularly over the last 6 weeks, on completing the jig. We'll have it mechanically complete end of March, which isn't too far away, or the first week of April, and we're looking to feed first ore into the jig in the middle of April. So that's going to allow us to move to stage two of the ramp up, which is a very important production step for us. The concentrators are already speeding along. This should be on Vox, very nice time-lapse video showing the steel arriving and going up very quickly on site, and we'll try and keep all those Vox supporters up to date on those time-lapse video updates on a regular basis over the next few weeks and months. So the concentrator is now speeding along after an initial delay in getting some of the steel to site, but we're very pleased to have broken the back to that. And we're looking forward to moving from production from the crusher and the old concentrator to production from the new crusher, the new jig, and the old concentrator, which is ramp up phase two. And we should be able to start that in mid-April.
Okay. Take us through just the phases, the ramp-ups, and what you're hoping to achieve production-wise then, if you could, Michael.
Okay. So we've been producing since November, December, and we've been steadily moving along with that. One of the primary objectives is to make sure that the plant operates, that we produce these specified product and we ship it to customers, and we've achieved that successfully to date. Mm-hmm. The key next step is ramp up phase two, which is to finish the jig and run the new crusher, the new jig, which allows us to significantly upgrade the quality and grade of the ore, and then feed that through the existing concentrator we have on site. That should allow us to effectively double production. We're looking at probably 40 to 50 tons a month, and that will be very important in terms of both cash flow and overall the smooth ramp up of the plant. Mm-hmm. The third phase is when the new concentrator is finished in the second quarter. Then we'll be able to go from new crusher to new jig to new concentrator, and that's where we'll have the much larger production capacity, and that's what our overall objective is for 2019, is to take the new concentrator up to 200 tons a month of design capacity by December 2019. We're pretty comfortable we can do that, but there's obviously a huge amount of work by the team to achieve that. 200 tons a month of tungsten concentrates equal at current prices of tin and tungsten to around about $3 million US dollars per month, and or $36 million in a full annual year. And we expect at current prices to earn a pretty good operating margin on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. So it's all going well there. And as regards your other projects, take us over what's happening there, Michael, if you could.
We're not a one project company. We've got Regor in northern Portugal, which is moving ahead. We've just that's going to be an underground mined via portals. We've just done the infill drilling around the portals. It's a very simple, very low cost development, but we're getting La Perilla moving first before we move on to Regor. But we'll be able to update the market on the geological work in the second quarter and on the contracts to put Regor into development in the third quarter of 2019. And back on, a more popular or also popular metal, gold, we've got the São Martinho gold discovery in central Portugal. We've already got 100,000 ounces there, but the UK's SRK is doing an update on that resource, and we'll certainly expect to be able to update the market on that gold resource in the middle of the second quarter. So we're looking forward to that as well. So two tungsten and tin and one gold. Yeah. Good progress on all fronts.
Yeah, absolutely. I know gold is getting a bit more attraction these days. You know, with all talk of global growth slowdown, people are looking to hedge a little bit, and gold is certainly shining a bit brighter at the moment, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. And look, we've applied for a trial mine license on that gold deposit. That'll take a little while to get in place, but you know, when you can go from a gold discovery to a gold mine, that's good progress.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. One final thing then, Michael, for people not following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please?
Okay, number one, our flagship mine, La Perilla Tungsten and Tin in southwestern Spain, is near completion and is going to move through the balance of 2019 to full-scale production. That's going to generate significant revenue and cash flows, and should be a big inflection point for the company. We have a portfolio of tungsten projects with La Perilla, Regua and Taroca that are going to drive growth, and we've got a great little gold deposit in central Portugal that will also provide further support for W Resources and its shareholders.
Marvellous stuff. Michael, good to chat to you, and like I say, lots going on there, so no doubt we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Hayden Locke, Chief Executive Officer of Emerson. EML is a ticker there. Hayden, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Good to be back.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm just looking at, you know, every week or so, every couple of weeks, you're releasing positive news, you know, slowly but surely. It's a big project, you know, for yourselves there, but you are ticking off those boxes in a positive manner, and we'll get into what you've completed today. Before we do, as always, if someone's not familiar with Emerson, just explain, if you could, Hayden, what you're all about.
Emerson's developing the world-class Chemisette Potash Project, which is located in northern Morocco. It is an industry leader in terms of capital cost of production and margins. We released a scoping study in November of last year, which basically showed that this is among the lowest capital cost projects in the world, and also among the highest projected margins. And as a result, it's got absolutely outstanding economics, and we're talking an NPV 10 based on industry expert forecasts of well over $1 billion. And currently trading at a fraction of that. In fact, I think less than 5% of that sort of value. So a very exciting project, huge strategic value. And we're really, as you say, just slowly but surely moving it forward and chipping off the milestones.
Yeah, I dread to think how many milestones there are, or how many boxes you have to tick, because there are certain ones that we see released by you that I'm sure most investors would never thought you had to do. And I think something like today is a very important milestone with the completion of environmental base study. Take us through what this means, Hayden, please.
Yeah, it really is a huge milestone for us, although it's probably not one that grabs so much attention. What I found in my career in mining is a lot of mining projects get blocked before they even get to the stage where they can be constructed because they can't address the potential environmental and social impacts that come with developing a large-scale industrial project. So it is very important that you get in and you have a good look at what are going to be your environmental impacts and what are going to be your social impacts, and you really start to look at that early on and make sure that there are no fatal flaws or red flags, as we call them, that could preclude you from developing your project. And so we've already done that. We've done it well ahead of schedule in terms of when most mining companies look at this, and the results are very favourable. It shows that there are no fatal flaws, no hurdles that we can't overcome in order to develop this potash project. So very exciting indeed.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the sort of baseline. So there's further environmental sort of assessments to go, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, so in order to move out to the mining license, so in order to apply for the mining license, which will be the next step, we have to complete an ESIA, an Environmental and Social Impact Assessment. That's really just a formalisation of the baseline work, and then okay, a much more detailed set of work to do to really say, here are all the environmental risks that we potentially pose, and here are the mitigants to those environmental risks, and how we're going to go about managing those environmental risks to make sure that in the future we can get finance from international banks, because they're all red hot on these issues, but also that we're going to manage this project in a sustainable way.
Yeah. And you know, the market there, what is it like at the moment, potash?
The market for potash is good. We're in a bit of a lull in the season, a traditional lull that occurs right before spring planting. So demand is pretty flat at the moment, but we're all the reports are that in the next couple of months, which is traditionally when demand ramps up, especially in markets like the US and Brazil, we're going to see further strength in that. Most of the majors are reporting that they're virtually sold out for the first quarter of this year, which is another good sign. And all of the majors are still reporting that they think 2019 is going to be another record year of demand. So pretty positive signs in the industry. You know, we're very happy with where the price is right now, which is it's still relatively low. It's still too low for a lot of other projects to even get incentivized to be built, because they just can't achieve the return on capital. But where we're sitting right now, where we're looking at north of 50% post-tax cash margins, sort of closer to 70% EBITDA margins. So we're in a very comfortable position. If the price goes up, that's great. But right now, it's very good for us in any case.
Yeah. And talking about milestones, what is the next sort of milestone you're hoping to tick off the list there?
We'll commence the metallurgical test work at some point in the next couple of weeks, I hope. It's just a matter of finding the right lab to do that work, and then we'll commence the feasibility studies. Probably the next really big milestone will be the resource upgrade, which I hope will occur sometime around the middle of the year, timing dependent on the drilling, which is still ongoing on the ground. And then there'll be probably some announcements on financing partners, some other MOUs that we're looking at signing in country that just really show that we're moving the project forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, one final thing, with three bits of that one final thing there. If someone's listening right now and not following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Fox and add you to their watch list, please.
Emerson owns 100% of the world-class Chemisette Potash project, which is among the lowest capital cost and highest margin projects globally, which makes it an incredibly strategically valuable asset, especially in the hands of a junior. We're rapidly progressing the project towards construction, as we've discussed on this podcast many times, and de-risking the project and unlocking, frankly, substantial value for our shareholders as we go. And 2019 is going to be a transformational year for the company as we begin to lock down the details of the project through the feasibility study and assess who we'll partner with and how we'll go about building this high-impact project. And that's going to result in a huge amount of news flow throughout the year.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Aidan, good to chat to you, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Malky, oil and gas sector specialist. You all right, fella?
Very well indeed. Thanks, Justin. And you?
Yeah, not too bad. So I assume you were watching the rugby on Saturday?
Yeah, I was there at Twickenham.
That was.
For my sins.
I know it didn't end the way England would like to end, but I thought just a phenomenal game. Like I say, it was written for a movie. It's almost like you wouldn't believe that. It was like a Rocky boxing film. The comeback is like phenomenal.
You wouldn't believe it.
But I can imagine. I mean, you must have been tense at one point. It looked like they were unstoppable coming back.
It was weird because I was sitting in the south end where England was scoring the tries in the first half, and we sort of mistakenly said, "Oh, well, the other end will get all the tries in the second half." And in the end, we got all the tries.
Yes. So good position there, but that hugely frustrating though, because England, like I said, started off almost a done deal by the end of the first half, wasn't it? And that's maybe the problem. They thought, that's it now. Once you sort of relax a bit, I suppose it's hard to get back up if someone comes back at you, isn't it?
It's very weird because Scotland played well. There was a breakaway, and England just they don't have plan B when things go wrong.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, they've like I said, they started off this tournament, Six Nations, like the winners, all of a sudden then, when it doesn't got a plan, and it didn't against Wales, they started to crumble a bit. And you think, what's going on? I think massive potential England had, but like I said, the game plan needs to be adjusted in some way. Anyway, let's get on to stocks. More important things than that. Stocks and shares.
Indeed, yeah.
Any news out, Malcolm? What's happening?
Yeah, there's a bit around since we last spoke. So this morning we've had Eco Atlantic. I'm a big fan of the stock. They've announced the updated CPR on the Orinduik block, which is in Guyana, offshore Guyana. And this has been a significant resource increase today. They've added the best part of a billion barrels. They've gone their P50 resource number, their estimate, is gone from 2913 million barrels to 3981 million barrels, which is the potential. This is why the stock is, you know, I put it in the bucket list a year ago at 30p, then it was 70, and now it's 90. But the potential could be, you know, it could be way higher, to be honest. And if you think of 15% of these sort of numbers, you know, they'd be significantly higher than this. And you know, it's the big hot postcode in world oil and gas at the moment, with Exxon drilling Hammerhead, but in the next door block, Stabroek block. And they're about to drill another well, which is very close to the Eco block. So one way or another, Eco is starting with Tullow and Total their drilling campaign in June of this year. Mm-hmm. So not long there. They've announced that their first target is going to be the Jethro target, looking for 215 million barrels of oil, but, you know, quite high chance of success, 43.2% chance of success. After that, they'll drill another one, probably equally sort of reasonably conservative, decent chance of success. But the interpretation of Hammerhead, and the good thing is that the company are not, you know, sort of saying too much about Hammerhead. It's obviously next door and probably comes into their block. But if they did drill a well in that part of the block, it would be 80% chance of success. So, you know, with Exxon announcing that their drilling's very shortly, and these wells don't take that long to drill, I can see nothing but good news coming through until we start to drill. Then what you do is, you know, depend on how you do things, but we'll talk about strategy nearer the time. Mm-hmm. But I think the upside for Eco Atlantic could be way, way more than this price.
Yeah, yeah. So the best estimate net to them is 597 million barrels. That's quite a big chunk, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you're talking about these sort of things before you've drilled them, or you decide, you know, if you were to have a success, how much it would be worth, the going rate is between $5 and $10 a barrel in the ground.
Yeah.
So if you go for, you know, $5 a barrel in the ground, or even $7, say $5 in the ground, mm-hmm. times that by the amount of oil net to them,
yeah,
and then look at the market cap of only £140 million.
Well, it's close to $3 billion.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Wow, and they are one of them at the moment. That's sort of Eco. What's their market?
95p, is it? No, 92p.
Yes, yeah, so they're 140 million they're valued at, and it could be valued at close to 3 billion.
What would happen is that they would get taken out at that stage.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you notice that they've appointed two very high profile, big shot London brokers. Well, they've appointed, I think, Berenberg as well. So they've got, you know, good advice there. They've got big players. I wouldn't be at all surprised if institutional shareholders weren't looking to buy into this one. They certainly should be, exposure to their oil portfolio. So, you know, I think they'd get taken out either, you know, by Total, who would be the obvious choice, because they've farmed into their own their space. But you know, anything could happen. So it's going to be a fun ride for the next few months.
Yeah, absolutely, marvelous stuff. What's next, Malky?
Well, good old Range Resources, who I've already had some inflow, inbound from this morning. This company is Range is based in Trinidad and onshore Trinidad, and it might be called like a fairground ride in the last few years, but most recently it's. Yeah, it's had a huge amount of debt on its books from the Chinese, and you know, people have been uncertain as to whether the size of the business in Trinidad is going to be enough to continue to make it worthwhile. And they've announced this morning that they've restructured the balance sheet. They've extended the maturity of the 20 million convertible out to November 2022. So no repayments until the maturity of that debt. And then, of course, they've got the Landocean debt, which they're going to pay through the issue of new shares, which will mean further dilution. Yeah. The biggest news is that actually the company is making an acquisition that would, as they say, take the company in a different direction. And we're talking a preschool education business in China here. So that is a new direction, all right?
Yeah. Really new.
So I think that we've effectively seen the end of Range Resources as we know it. The due diligence is scheduled to finish in April, so we'll see an announcement sometime then. It's a reverse takeover under the code, so the shares are suspended. They're going to review the oil and gas business. Yeah, they've got two sides of it. They've got the exploration acreage and all the onshore licenses, some of which pay the top end of the Trinidad tax regime, which is hard at the best of times. And they've got a service business with some really high quality rigs and stuff in there, all of which will be needed in Trinidad and in the Caribbean at some stage. So it might be that the other Trinidad companies, and I think we're talking about Trinity, Columbus, Touchstone, and Predator, you know, that they might, any or all of those might be interested in some of what Range are probably going to divest. And it'll be interesting to see what happens to the oil services company, the rig business.
Yeah.
But I do think this is we are seeing a step change. If they go ahead and the due diligence is okay and they buy a preschool education business in China, I don't think it'll be in the oil and gas sector for much longer, Justin.
No, doesn't look like.
Yeah,
exactly. So it's very odd that way. There we are. But, okay, what else is happening, Melky?
Well, I mean, we've talked about, I occasionally talk about Bahamas Petroleum, and I talked about that company to you a few weeks ago. They duly announced that last week that they'd raised $2.5 million at 1.6p a share. The shares run up and down like it's going out of style. If you remember this time last year, they had a very good run-up. They went up to, I think, 7 or 8p on the back of a substantial, a major looking at farming into their acreage in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
And that company paid them significant fees for exclusivity and then walked away at the last minute. Now, the raise last week was because they need working capital just to run the business. But this is a bit of a long shot, but talk in the market is that the big fish that they lost last year may be back in the data room. They haven't ever announced who the big fish is. I even had a dispute with somebody recently who said that I called them a super major and it was a major. I haven't got a clue. But it's still a very high-risk play, Bahamas. But, I mean, there are huge structures in down there, and we know that at some stage somebody will have a go at it. It's obviously the most difficult part of the world to drill an exploration well offshore the Bahamas, as you can imagine. Some people will rule themselves out on environmental grounds and or whatever cost to the tourism business if anything went wrong. But with the data room open, and I know that there are companies looking at it, whether or not it's the same person as last year, the company, although they're totally dependent, may well get a partner to farm in, which means that they'll get to drill at long last as well, because the company's only got the money they're raising at the moment just to keep going. So, you know, they can't afford to drill anything. So they need to be carried on this well. And when this well is, you know, if they get a fine partner, they'll have to, you know, get themselves a deal. And it won't be the best farm out terms you've ever seen, because the person coming in is clearly, has got the gloves on and will be able to do quite a hard deal. But if it means that Bahamas still have, 10 or 20% of this, in terms of the share price and the market cap of, what it is at the moment is fairly modest. There might just be one more go in it for Bahamas Petroleum, Justin.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's been a, you know, for a good trade to trade that share, because like you say, he has like a roller coaster and he's fallen off the track at one point and then got back on it. So between 1 and 7 pence, up and down like crazy.
And I mean that 7 pence was obviously when when the major was in last year, looking at it. And since then, it say raised money at 1.6p last week. So
yeah, marvelous. Anything else there, Malky? Happening?
Not really. We've got Hurricane share prices beginning to pick up. We're waiting. They've been waiting patiently for better weather in the west of Shetland, and as we've all been told, look out the window now. They couldn't do anything. Well, we've had these very strong winds, and we know that we've had winds like this for 3 or 4 weeks now. Mm-hmm. And you can't move a rig around, but the Aika Maizu, which is the FPSO, has been waiting patiently in the Cromarty Firth. The good thing is that in this day and age, Justin, you can actually go tracking these vessels.
Yeah.
So, you can actually find out. So the moment the thing comes out of harbour, all the retail shareholders are on the case. And given the share price movement in the last 24, 48 hours, it looks like it may be on the move. And, with better weather, that's what they're looking for, because they're waiting to tie it into the Lancaster early production system.
Yeah, do you know what? I dread to think what the weather's like, off the Shetland area and all that, because it's bad enough inland at the moment, isn't it? Can you imagine what it's like up there?
I mean, we've had very heavy winds. They nearly had to stop Cheltenham last week for that.
Yeah.
And on Saturday evening, on the way home from Twickenham, it was blowing a gale.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Is that it, Malky?
That is it for this week, Justin. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Well, we'll catch up next week, Malky.
Look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Stepick, Executive Editor of Money Week Magazine and author of Skeptical Investor, How Contrarians Bet Against the Market and Win. And you too can. Oh, sorry, you can too. I went contrarian on your title then, John.
I'm very good.
Hello. So, do you know what? I've got to admit, and I say this sometimes as a sort of ploy, but I haven't read the book. I want you to sell it to me. But I've read through a summary of it. I like it already, because I'm an active investor. I understand about contrarianism, and some people think it's just taking the opposite side of the market, which it's not really. So I'm really interested in your book, and I think I will be a buyer of it. So first of all, it's probably worth going into your background, John. What are you all about then?
Yeah, basically, I'm a journalist, so I've been writing about business and finance and investing for about 15, 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And I started out writing for a newswire. I started out writing for Teletext, which some of your older I remember.
Listen, I remember used to watching shares. My grandfather, used to own. He used to own shares. I don't know if one of the big nationalised. Oh, it was nationalised, but one of the big sort of companies. And we used to watch his shares on that. And literally, they're in alphabetical order, broken down into sort of chunks. So like A to H, companies begin with A to H would be on 40 pages. And so they'd flick around, and if we missed it, he'd say, "Keep an eye out for BT or something ridiculous like that." And if we missed it, we'd have to wait for another 39 pages to go around. It's ridiculous, but carry on, sorry.
Oh, it was great. No, I mean, it was like the kind of dinosaur era internet. But that was, it was actually a really useful training ground, because I remember when I first went there, it hadn't ever occurred to me there were actual human beings writing the stories that were, you know, going up on the telly every day. And so you had to, like, you know, kind of drag off company results, because we'd go in first thing in the morning, the RNS would all be churning out the latest results, and you'd have to read through, you know, BT's fourth quarter report and then summarise it in 65 words. Yeah. And get that up on the screen within kind of 20 minutes. So it was a really useful kind of, you know,
yeah, it's a skill.
Deep-end training ground.
Yeah.
And then I moved on to Money Week. And Money Week, hopefully, you know, a lot of your listeners will be familiar with it, or even subscribers. But we write, obviously, about investing, everything from the kind of big picture to individual shares, bonds, etc., etc. And one of the kind of... Our tone tends to be contrarian, or we favour a contrarian approach, or looking at things from a slightly different angle to perhaps the kind of the mainstream press. And so I've been kind of, you know, thinking this way and trying to invest like this myself for a long time. But one of the things that I've noticed is that any time I talk to a fund manager, or you read some interview with a fund manager, they always say, "Oh yeah, I'm a bit of a contrarian."
Yeah.
And you're kind of thinking, yeah, but you know, you can't all be contrarians. So it's, you know, it's clearly a very desirable trait, but no one ever sits down and actually defines what it is. So I guess what I wanted to do with this book was to sort of investigate it in a bit more detail and try and pin down a bit more what actually thinking and acting like a contrarian involves, and what you have to do. Because as you said at the start there, there are kind of a lot of cliches about it. Yeah. You know, you read things like, you know, you should zig when the market's zagging, you know, or, you know, things like buy when there's blood on the streets. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's an element of truth to those things, but they're really not at all helpful, because, you know, a lot of the time the market's right. That's kind of, that's why we have markets, because they kind of, you know, they do aggregate information very well, and they do kind of work a lot of the time. So you have to be selective. It's not just about saying, you know, the market's going up, I'd better short it, or, you know, the market's crashing, it's time to buy. No, you just, there's a lot more to it than that. So I guess that's what I wanted to investigate with the book.
Yeah, well, do you know what? On your jacket sort of text there, you outlined some of the best contrarian plays ever. And you say that the housing, I mean, it was sort of summarised excellently in the film The Big Short, I suppose, the housing crash in 2018. And you got George Soros, you know, the billion-dollar bet against the Bank of England in 1992. I mean, those were amazing contrarian plays, aren't they? So is that what you mean by contrarian plays, where all the market thinks it's going one way and, you know, some people think it's not?
There's that, and I think the thing with the Soros bet, for example, and betting against the Bank of England was, it was that it's not so much about simply saying, you know, going in the opposite direction to the market. I mean, both those bets with Soros and the kind of big short, I mean, other people had tried to short the US housing market, but they'd failed. I mean, where those guys succeeded was that, A, they did the legwork. I mean, they had, you know, they were going out visiting people who actually were the ones who were on the hook for these mortgages themselves. Mm-hmm. And that was one reason that they realised just how pear-shaped everything was going to go. But then they also had to be both patient enough and find a way to make that trade, because it was a very complicated trade to make. So it wasn't just about being clever enough to have the hunch that the market was overvalued, because at any given time, lots of people think the market's overvalued, particularly in things like the tech bubble or, you know, the US housing market example, is finding ways to then profit from that, and also ways to be able to take advantage of it and stay in the trade without getting kicked out. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, it's a lot more than just, you know, having a good hunch and then you know, kind of just rolling with it.
You've gone with it. You say it's basically investing in a skeptical way. Is that right?
Yeah, it's taking that kind of skeptical approach, the kind of skeptical mindset. Because I suppose I started out and I think Michael Mauboussin, who's a big kind of investment analyst who writes about this stuff a lot, I think makes the kind of best summary of what contrarian investing is. And it's where you've got, there's a big gap between the fundamentals and the expectations that the market has priced in. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for somewhere where the reality on the ground is actually not being reflected in the market. And there are lots of reasons why that can happen, because most of the time the market is reasonably efficient. As I said, you know, the reason we have markets is because they are good at kind of getting everyone's views on prices and, you know, grouping it all together. But there are times whenever the market just runs away with itself. And one key to being able to spot that or understand that is to understand the psychological flaws that we've all got. Because those are the things that don't change. It's like, you know, there's always that John Templeton quote about, you know, the most expensive words in the English language are this time, it's different.
Yeah.
But the reality is that it's often different. It's almost always different. There's usually, you know, there's different things happening, there's different technologies. But the one thing that doesn't change is human behaviour. And so if you can get a better handle on human behaviour, and understand both the kind of mistakes that other investors make and the mistakes that you're prone to yourself, and then find ways to stop yourself from making those mistakes, then I think that gives you a kind of head start on other people in the market.
Yeah.
It's a lot of it's more about your mindset than any specific strategy.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I suppose one of the most recent kind of bubbles, I don't know if you agree, has been the Bitcoin sort of bubble, where it's just...
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, the financial... I mean, you know, because I got involved in a bit of cryptocurrency. First of all, it's hard work to trade that thing. You have to go online and set up accounts and all this stuff. But first of all, you know, some of the market caps, the valuations of these companies, just because they had released a coin, was like the dot-com boom. In fact, worse than that. And, they would see... I'd say a decent company on AIM, for example, with decent assets, like and be valued at, say, you know, 10, 20 million, a microcap. And you get these companies just set up, and overnight they'd release a coin, and they'd be worth 100 million. And you think, well, hang on, that doesn't make any sense. They're not generating anything at all. And I mean, what's that value based on? It's based on a tech that people believe is going to be the future. We have no idea whether it will. And the Bitcoin price went up to sort of $20,000 pretty much. And there were people putting remortgage in their houses, and they're going to these conferences where there were thousands of people in auditoriums saying, this is going to the moon, guys, you know, and or expecting this to be £100,000 by next year. And I thought, this is nuts. And the people were telling me, no, it's just different because, and I was arguing with people on Twitter saying, I don't think it is. And it's different because it's not been seen before. And I thought, that was nuts, wasn't it? You know, and it popped, you know.
It was crazy. But again, it's like it really illustrates how these things work, because it was very similar to the tech bubble from the point of view that you had a new technology. And one of the key things there is that people were able to, because I think one of the big things about contrarian or skeptical thinking is that you have to remember that things move in cycles.
Yeah.
But human beings tend to think in straight lines. Mm-hmm. So like we extrapolate. And the more freedom you've got to extrapolate and go blue sky thinking, the wilder a bubble can get. So like with the tech thing, it was all about how the internet was going to change the world. And the thing is that the internet did change the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, the prices that it reached in 2000 were probably about 20 years too early. And it was the same with Bitcoin. You know, so people are sitting there and they could imagine any sort of price because there were no fundamentals. But then you've also got the fact the price keeps going up. And when the price keeps going up, people start to refer to the price and they start thinking, everyone else must know something that I don't, so I'd better get in here before it goes up even higher. And you get that sort of self-fulfilling feeding spiral where everyone, in effect, what's happening is that the price is informing the market, and then investors are jumping in because they see the price going higher and they assume that everyone else must know something that they don't. Again, you know, that's, and then eventually just reaches a point where it's kind of unsustainable. And don't get wrong, I think that Bitcoin will at some point play some sort of role in the financial system, you know, or blockchain or whatever it is. You know, it might end up being like the tech bubble where it's just, you know, it's blowing up too early. And obviously Bitcoin still exists, even if a lot of the other ones have died off. But yeah, I mean, getting up to, you know, the kind of price action kind of last year was just nuts.
Yeah. So you mentioned here that in your contents or listing, you've got one of the titles is Your Big Advantage Over the Professionals. So you mentioned there that sometimes, you know, first of all, it's hard to spot bubbles, isn't it? Because, like you said, you know, by definition, people at the time, you know, not many people think they're bubbles, you know. And so how do you spot that? And what is the advantage that, you know, say, an individual private investor has over the professionals?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really important because there's obviously the professionals kind of dominate the market because they're the big institutions. So it's them and it's you as a private investor, basically. So if you understand the things that that drive them, then you can get a better idea of how you can avoid making those same mistakes. And so there's kind of one big risk that the professionals have that we don't have, and that's career risk. So what that is that basically if a professional fund manager comes along, sees something like, you know, the tech bubble, not Bitcoin so much because most of them were able to set that one out. They didn't have to keep up with that. But call it the tech bubble. They kind of have to be invested in that sort of stuff because if 3 months goes by and they get their quarterly report and they've underperformed, you know, the other fund managers in their sector, then they're going to lose clients and they might get fired. Mm-hmm. So career risk basically makes these guys take a shorter term view. And I mean, I remember there's a great story. Guy called Jeremy Grantham, big kind of US fund manager, very smart guy. Mm-hmm. He sat out the tech bubble in the late 90s and he went to this conference and took a survey of, I think it was about 1,000 fund managers were there. And he asked them two questions. And one was, I think the first question was, if tech stock valuations go back to something near normality, will the market crash? And then the second question was, do you think tech stocks will go back to normal levels of PE? And about 99% of the guys there said, yes, I think the market will crash. And yes, I think tech stocks are overvalued and they're going to collapse. But they were all in tech stocks anyway, because there was nothing they could do. And I mean, there's the other famous story of that fund manager, Tony Dye, who sat out the tech bubble, ended up getting fired something like, I think it was the month that the bubble burst, the month that the NASDAQ topped out. And, you know, it's the problem is that, you know, you don't have a job anymore. So it's the fact that you're right hasn't made any difference.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is if you're a private investor, you don't have that. It's like, there is literally no one that you have to justify your performance on a 3-month basis to. So as long as you can resist doing that to yourself, which is a whole other, you know, topic, then you do have an advantage because you can actually afford to take a longer term view than these guys can. And I think that's it's good for private investors to understand that because it is easy to think, well, I'm completely outgunned, you know, by the professionals. You know, they've got loads of guys researching stuff all the time. They're much cleverer than me. They've been doing this for longer. But I think it's important to wrap your head around that fact. Yeah. They have career risk and you don't.
Yeah, it's true, Joe. I spoke to, in fact, a guy who released a book recently, about a year ago, and he was a fund manager, and he said the problem, you know, the problem is flawed. Their system is flawed because the quarterlies, they have to sort of, it is too much of a short-termism view, you know, and you've got to try to perform for every quarter, whereas you're not looking at the mid to long term. You can't take advantage of like I said, in fact, if you are looking to buy stuff cheap, you can't really, because it may take a long time to play out. You can't tell how long it'll take. All you know is the fundamentals look good for it to play out in your way, but you can't really take that long-term view because you have to perform on a quarterly level. But, it's very interesting there. So, you mentioned, I quite like it, because investing is a lot about, you know, psychology. And like I said, there's not a lot separating a successful investor from a non-successful or unsuccessful investor apart from the way they think. You got one of your chapters there, Beating Your Brain, a Process Versus Outcome. What's that all about?
Well, basically, that is just what we have, obviously, we have a lot of psychological flaws, and I suspect that a lot of your listeners have heard of them. So I don't go through them exhaustively in the book, because, like I said, you know, most people have heard of things like anchoring. You know, anchoring is where, you know, you've seen the share, say the share's been £10 and then there's a profit warning that drops to £5, but yeah, in your head you've still got, oh, it's not, but surely it's worth £10 and it'll get back up there.
I see this all the time. I see people suggest a stock to me, right, on Twitter, and I say, what's happening? And they've had a profit warning or something ridiculous, and they say, yeah, 2 years back, this was 40 quid a share. It's now 50 pence. I think that's got nothing to do with it. You know, it's got nothing
exactly
to do. That's ridiculous. So, yeah, anyway, carry on, sorry.
No, you're right. I mean, that's it. So you've got that. You've got confirmation bias, which is probably, I'd say, it's probably the worst one, because actually you see a lot of this just now, particularly, I mean, Twitter helps to bring it out in people, but particularly things like Brexit. You know, if you voted Leave or you support a certain way of getting out the EU, then you'll collect all the information that backs up your view, and you'll ignore anything that contradicts it. Or if you're a Remainer, then you'll only read headlines in the FT and you'll ignore, you know, all the headlines in, you know, the Telegraph or whatever, because you only want to read and understand what backs up your pre-existing point of view. And obviously that's a massive problem for investors, because if you're as soon as you're in a stock, you know, you're already biased to want to believe the best for it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've immediately got that problem there. So anyway, again, back to the process versus outcome thing, what you need to do is to set up a kind of a process of investing. And I'm talking about just things like your physical environment, and how you go about investing, how you go about research, so that you have a sound process for arriving at investment decisions, both buying and selling decisions. Now, some of those might go wrong. You know, just because you've got a good process doesn't mean that you'll get a good outcome. But it means that on average, as long as your process is sound, you should do better than if you have a bad process. So that the whole point is about trying to control yourself. And one of the main tips actually that I put in that section is simply sit down and keep an investment diary. So whenever you buy a stock, you write down, you know, all the things like, you know, the date, the share price, all the rest of it, and then also why you bought it, you know, a very clear rationale for why you kind of purchased it. Because at some point in the future, you know, say there is a profit warning or something like that, you're going to want to revisit that and remind yourself of, well, actually, why did I buy this? Because we also have this habit of justifying our decisions after the fact. Mm-hmm. So if you don't write down at the time exactly why you thought this was a good bet, then further down the line, if that, you know, if you get challenged on that, then you'll start to adapt, you know, and basically make things up about why you bought it. That actually had nothing to do with your rationale at the time. So it's just that way of keeping yourself honest, basically.
I think it was George Soros. Apparently, he looks for the opposite opinion to anything. If he's, you know, taking a position in something, he searches out, you know, opposite opinions, because that makes sure his, you know, his reasoning is sound, you know, rather than just looking for confirmation all the time, you know.
Oh no, definitely. I mean, you should do that. I mean, it's hard for people to do that. There's a story actually in the book as well about Hugh Hendry, who's a fund manager that probably a lot of you have kind of heard of, and you know, I got a lot of time for Hugh, and I always enjoyed he used to kind of, during the financial crisis, he'd go on Newsnight and on the Eurozone crisis, and he'd, you know, slag off kind of European politicians and world economists for being out of touch and all the rest of it, and it was, you know, quite funny. But he talked about how, because he did very well during the 2008 crisis and then he struggled after that. And he did an interview with a colleague of mine, Meryn Somerset Webb, where he talked about how when kind of bearish newsletters and things would come into his office, then he would read them, and he sort of described it as luxuriating in these polemics, because they backed up what he already thought. But then he was saying, you know, that was a mistake, because ultimately I'm not here to kind of moralise about the market. I'm here to try and be right. So I think that's really, really valuable. You know, you want to read quality stuff. You don't just want to read. I know my journalist saying this, and you know, it's probably I shouldn't moan.
Subscribe to Money Week.
Yes, you should subscribe to Money Week. But I'm also thinking, you know, there is a lot of guff printed in the papers, and there's a lot of opinionising and an awful lot of just empty kind of verbiage. And the same on the net, you know. So what you want to do is, you want to find kind of commentators and, you know, maybe some fund managers, maybe some analysts, maybe some writers, maybe bloggers, that kind of thing. People whose views that you kind of trust, and then kind of, you know, pick them up whenever they're disagreeing with you, and then try and figure out, well, actually, this, I know this person's intelligent, and I know that they argue in good faith, basically. So why do they believe this, as opposed to what I believe? And then if you are struggling to put those, you know, to counteract their arguments, then maybe you should reconsider your investment case, because it's clearly not as sound as you think it is.
Marvellous stuff, yes. Okay, and you have got a thing there. I mean, I don't want to go through every chapter, but because there's no point in buying the book. But
there's always point in buying the book.
Yeah, but what I find is, it comes back to Warren Buffett, really, this, and he's a sort of value investor. And you say about finding, the world's cheapest markets, and to a certain extent, you know, if you get a good company, good price, over the long term, you'll always do quite well, you know, as long as the company performs consistently. And so you say about finding how to find the world's cheapest markets. And do you mean to invest in individual stocks, or do you invest in trackers, or what in that respect?
Well, in that particular chapter, although I do talk about finding value stocks in another chapter, and kind of, you know, looking at individual stocks, but with finding the world's cheapest markets, that is basically just looking at... There's a guy called Meb Faber who's done a lot of interesting work on this. And in effect, what he found is that if you use trackers to buy the cheapest markets in the world, usually as sort of measured by the CAPE ratio, so the long-term price-earnings ratio, or, you know, price-to-book, a few different kind of measures that you can do it on, but CAPE is the kind of big one. Yeah. And if you buy the ones whenever they're, usually if they're below 10, then over the next couple of years, it's really not actually a very long holding period. You know, the average return was, you know, really pretty impressive, kind of, you know, around about 30% odds in the first year. And so basically that's just a matter of buying individual country stock exchanges whenever they are, you know, at the bottom of the cycle is what it boils down to. And one reason I like that idea is because A, you get a lot of diversification, you know, so you don't buy one market, maybe buy kind of, you know, the bottom five or six. And then also within that, obviously, it's entire indices, so you don't have any individual company risk as such. And so it's a sort of, it's a low kind of, you don't have to do a huge amount of research to be able to do that. And if you kind of rebalance maybe like once a year or something like that, and do it with a section of your portfolio rather than the whole thing, then that's quite a promising way to invest in, you know, cheap markets and make decent returns over the longer term, without having to do a wild amount of research. I mean, it does mean that you have to hold your nose and buy some really ugly looking markets, ugly looking times, but that's contrarian investing. That's the reason they look ugly, is because, you know, nobody wants them, because there's kind of like something going on. Like, you know, for during the Eurozone crisis, kind of like Italy and Greece were among the cheapest markets in the world. And then they did bounce back very nicely once that had been sorted out in 2012. So it's things like that is what I'm talking about in that particular chapter.
Well, do you know what? You just convinced me. The other day, I looked at a BlackRock tracker fund for Turkey. you know? And Turkey, and Turkey's like literally, you know, they're in a bit of a mess. They've gone into recession, haven't they? And I think their lira has gone crazy, and Trump's not a big fan of them. But I thought, if I'm going to take, you know, I think they're just technically they've gone into recession, 2 quarters, of course, contraction, the second is bigger. Yeah. So I think I'll wait a month or so or see what. But I mean, I think, you know, if you look at it now, and you talk about a year, 2 years, of course it should improve, you know, after a while, and obviously not risk too much on it. But I mean, it is, and this fund is spread across about 50 or 100 stocks in Turkey. So it's, you know, it's not like you're betting on one stock, you know. So, and I did the same with the Russian ETF as well. When we had the oil price crashing at, you know, 30, 25 bucks, I think it hit one point. I did the same because Russia's, you know, largely get their revenue from oil and gas. And I, you know, took an ETF out on the Russian economy, basically, the top 100 stocks that it was. And that played out very well, you know. Like I said, it's not that risky because it was priced in pretty much. It was been battered down for ages, you know, but it rebounded, you know.
No, you're right. And I mean, the thing with individual countries is that, I mean, obviously there are risks that can demolish a country, but they are quite, you know, few and far between. I mean, I personally don't like investing in Russia, for example, because I don't like the authoritarian kind of stance of the government and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But from a purely investment point of view, I can entirely see why it makes sense to do it, because, you know, it is cyclical. It is related to the oil price. Whatever else he's going to do, Putin is not likely to go back directly to communism anytime soon, because communism is probably the one thing, you know, where the state just nationalizes everything. Then you will lose your money if you're invested in a, you know, in a stock market. And that's happened in the past, you know, a long time ago in both Russia and China. Yeah. But other than that, you know, even if an economy is doing badly, you know, the companies are still operating. You know, we're talking about these are real assets here. I mean, I remember with the Eurozone crisis, one point that somebody made about Italy, for example, was that, yeah, but, you know, even if Italy leaves the euro and it's got the lira, then there are still actual factories there. It doesn't matter that they're valued in lira rather than euro, as long as they're cheap enough to buy just now. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'm just looking at a wee chart today, actually, just now in front of me. And according to the people that I tend to get this information off, a website called Star Capital, Turkey's about the second cheapest market in the world right now. So, yeah, I can see why you're tempted.
Well, yeah, I just looked on the iShares and BlackRock, and they ordered them via a performance. You can look at performance. And I looked across, and I'm for the last year, Turkey's the worst performing ETF. It's down 41%. I was thinking, okay, well, if I can scale into that slowly. And I always have a rule, I never go over 10% of my entire portfolio worth in any one holding. So I'm never going to be overexposed to Turkey. You know, it's just a little play, you know. So, John, I like the sound of the book. I'm gonna get it, I'm going to read it, and I'm sure it'll come up with lots of interesting facts, and you've reflected some of them here in the interview. So thanks for coming on. And it's out now, I assume, is it?
Yeah, it's out now. You can get it through Harriman House or Amazon. Thanks. That was a real pleasure, Justin. It was good talking to you.
Just to remind people, it's called The Skeptical Investor by John Stepick. It's How Contrarians Bet Against the Market and Win, and You Can Too. And I'm seeing here on Harriman House, it's £14.99. Paperback ebook is a penny short of 10 quid. It's a bargain. And so
bargain.
I'll be getting that. Excellent. John, thanks very much, and hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Magic. Thanks, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Bacanora Lithium, BCN. At four, Block Energy, BLOE. At three, Strategic Minerals, SML. At two, Bidstack Group, BIDS. And I've shared my opinion and thoughts on them on the weekend. Very excited about it. In fact, it's one of the most exciting companies I've ever held, I think. The potential is it could be massive. Who knows? You know, they're just started their journey. But very excited about Bidstack. And number one, Wide Sales Group. Change of direction, of course. They're going to sort of media and all that stuff with some guys there. You speak Union Lad. So we'll see what they did. WDC is the ticker there. Top five most liked RNSs came from the following companies. At five, Oriel Resources. 8 kilometre long gold anomaly confirmed at Wapuzi. At four, Motive Bio. Appointment of Bruce Williams as interim chairman. At three, Strategic Minerals. They acquire a balance of Redmore. At two, Kora Gold. Up to 97% gold recovery indicated at Sanankoro. And at one, it's Talau Energy or Talu Energy Field Operations Update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.